Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Learning Well. We've got a fun and exciting show for you today. And today I have Dr. Jerry Zanster back with the podcast, and we're going to be discussing learning science again. So we heard from a lot of you that you'd like to hear more about some specific topics. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to dig into three specific learning science topics. But I thought first I'd give Jerry an opportunity to say hi to all of you and maybe introduce yourself for people that don't know who you are.
All right. So my name is Jerry Zanstra. I am the Chief Strategy Officer at Mindspring. And a big part of my role is the opportunity to sit quietly and think. And I get to do that a lot with Miriam. We think through some of the thorny issues related to learning and some of the problems, and we get to work on developing solutions. That's far more fun than thinking about the problem.
Right.
So that's my role, and that's what I get to do.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking over interesting things, and with the ubiquitous whiteboard and marker, podcast kind of puts a limit on that. Yeah, it's a little different, but so we've spent really, I'd say, the last 6 months or more in various ways discussing different kinds of learning science. And I do want to remind our listeners that there's a lot of overlap, and we're not here to say there are exactly six types of learning science, which, you know, in fact, that's not true at all. Mm-hmm. In some of the things that we have written or talked about, we've kind of called out different areas, and that's what we wanted to do today. But the interesting thing with all of that is we can kind of sit here, like Jerry said, and think about problems, talk about learning science, but the reality is we also live in the real world every day, and we can talk about a perfect solution using learning science, and then we look at our world, and we have this huge either forced remote work or now a lot of requested flexible work, remote work. And so our goal today is to not really talk about learning science in a vacuum, but to talk about how in the world do we create the best possible learning experience with applying good learning science, and think about the fact that that's most likely going to be a digital experience, a virtual experience for someone working at home.
Or at least that'll be an option.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. So we've talked about these topics before, but I just very recently read another training industry magazine. I'll put the links in the show notes, but they talk about some disruptive factors this year. And I think a couple of them, right, as if the past few years haven't been just entirely.
Because we need more things being disrupted.
Right. Right. And they talked a huge amount about fusing business with learning and development, and the whole, you know, topics we've talked about, the great resignation, and not even that so much as trying to acquire new talent and retain talent, along with, it shouldn't seem disruptive to create a great learning experience, but that is in fact their number two listed. Mm-hmm. And then also try to acclimate to what they're calling a permanent hybrid workspace. So that's kind of, I guess, the framework we want to work in today. How do we talk about learning science in that kind of framework?
I think we were gently heading this way until 2000 and COVID, and then we were far less gently heading this way.
Not so gently.
Right. It's not going to shift entirely to everything. Everybody's working remote, and everything is virtually done for learning. But that emphasis has gotten a lot higher and a lot bigger in the last couple of years, for sure.
Yeah, and I know in a previous podcast I had talked with one of our guests about sort of our fear that there would be this impression that emergency learning was the best that there could be. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited to talk with you today about learning science, because I think it really is forcing a lot of corporate America, a lot of higher ed, too. We've had a little time to breathe now and to step back and evaluate and say, actually, there's a lot we can do better, and we should do better,
right.
And here's why.
Yep.
So on an upcoming podcast, we're actually going to have a cognitive neuroscience expert come in. I'm not going to make any assumptions here, Jerry. But
that person isn't me, right?
It's not
okay.
You.
Good. Yeah, good.
Okay. So what we wanted to do today was talk about three other topics, psychology, sociology, and consumer science. But I get in my head, even, I mean, I've done a lot of research on this, and we've had to sort of sift through cognitive brain science, neuroscience, and then some of that seems to tie to psychology. And so what's the difference between a brain science and psychology and sociology? How do we sift those out?
I think from a learning perspective, we should think of them as siblings. They are all closely related. And it's hard to talk about cognitive science without psychology. It's hard to talk about psychology without factoring in some sociological stuff. So all of these things sort of play in together. And from a learning perspective, I think that they all inform people who create learning for a living and people who think about and build learning. It's hard to take any of them out without missing something. And like you said, it's not that this is the all-inclusive list. Maybe there's three or four more. But it would be a significant miss, I think, if people were thinking about and working on learning and training and development without thinking about the human being. Mm-hmm. That's really what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. These are different ways of considering how the human being functions, how the human being thinks and reacts and is motivated and relates. All of those things have to factor into learning, I think.
Yeah, and there's a whole evolution, obviously, in education. You know, we talk about educating the whole person and all of that. And that's a fairly recent trend. And when I say recent, I think, probably the last 30 years or less. So I don't have personal experience, but I know from hearing stories. I mean, I don't think your 1940s classroom was too worried about educating person.
Wait. I was not educated in the 1940s.
I didn't say you were either. No.
Okay. All right.
No, I was trying to put it far enough back.
There we go.
That I was safe.
Beyond both of us. Right. Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. The idea of the whole person, how could you not do that? I mean, it's an emphasis lately, but it's a long time in coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it should have been obvious a long time ago.
Yeah. And I think that, what these past couple of years have taught us, it's given us a lot of data, especially, I think, normally we focus on adult learning theory here and corporate learning and higher ed, but when you put an entire world's worth of children, K-12 online for a year and a half in various ways, better, worse, all of that.
With very little prep time.
And parents or support systems or lack of support systems, I think if anything, that really called into, again, into the forefront, the fact that we're educating a whole person, and that's where the struggles usually came from, the lack of paying attention to those other issues.
It's not just transferring knowledge and transferring files from one location to another.
Exactly. So why don't you just talk to us a little bit about how psychology in general, what are some of the principles and how do we apply those to learning?
Well, I think I should speak to my qualifications first. I was a psychology major about 35 years ago in college.
So I didn't even know that.
There we go. I didn't remember that either. I did.
That speaks to cognitive science.
Just a memory issue. Very generally, psychology is basically the study of the human mind and human behavior. And it encapsulates things like emotion. What is emotion? Where does it come from? It touches on memory. Psychologists spend a great deal of time, and again, this is where you kind of bleed into cognitive sciences, but what is memory? How do you make things sticky and so on? This touches on consumer science, but how is attention distributed? Mm-hmm. How do you get somebody's attention? How do you keep somebody's attention? What is it in our psychological makeup that makes us pay attention or choose to ignore things? And we do both of those things all the time. What motivates us? Mm-hmm. And so all of those things, I mean, emotion is a big part of learning. Memory is a huge part of learning. Getting somebody's attention and figuring out how to motivate them. All of those things have to play into learning. And all of those things are where psychology can inform us. And so I think that's the basic touch point.
Yeah, I think we are probably far more familiar applying psychology than we think. We just don't always use those words. Right. So we'll talk a lot about engaging the learner, motivating the learner. We'll talk about telling a story because a story really, well, in reality, the reason a story helps a learner and is more interesting is A, it does engage them. B, they retain it because they can relate it to something they already know, which again is cognitive science, but they also might have these interesting, excited, pleasant feelings as they're listening, which is, so I do think that we may not always say, I'm applying the science of psychology to this learning experience. We are often doing it.
Well, it's a little bit like cooking, right? Cooking, baking, grilling, it's all chemistry. You know, you're following certain chemistry principles. It's much like that. We might call it something different, but we all know how temperature and works, and heat works, and pressure works, and cold works. All of those things are physics, and we know those things. So that's how we operate.
Yes, that explains why I was planning on using my grill the other night, because it's finally warm in Michigan. And I remembered that the last time I used it, there was so much burnt stuff in the bottom that I had a big fire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I don't understand enough about chemistry, so I didn't start it. I was just worried about the whole situation.
No, you're fine. That's called a self-cleaning grill. Just let it burn off.
I don't think I have a self-cleaning. I might have a self-cleaning house. That's the problem.
That's bad.
Yeah. Well, so if we think about psychology then, and we just talked about like these past couple of years, let's start with sort of the negative. What are some of the psychological sort of downsides if we're just purely virtual remote learning?
There are several, and they are important. And I know those of us who are, you know, digital learning evangelists don't sometimes want to talk about these things. But the research shows that, you know, there is the potential, and I want to emphasize potential. There is the potential for significantly increased stress levels among remote learners. There are indicators that show increases in rates of depression. There can be a very high level of frustration. And we'll talk about why. Because if we understand what's happening, we understand why it's happening, then it allows us to mitigate some of those things. But there's a fairly high level of frustration. And if you are an online learner, you probably already know and can think of examples, or you have children that suddenly were shifted to remote learning. You know a lot about the frustrations of it. And then this touches a bit on the sociological part, but there's a real possibility of isolation here. And there are some things that, you know, really impact learning. So let's talk about why.
Yeah, give us some examples or help us understand that.
Yeah, part of the stress and the frustration, even the depression, can come from things like technical difficulties. It doesn't work the way it's supposed to work. And there is literally no one in the room to help you. So there's a glitch in the software, or you end up getting lost. I've gotten lost in software many times where how do I get back to what I was doing? How do I recapture that document? It went somewhere. How do I find those things again? And to do that in isolation is much harder than when you have, you know, in a K-12 school, you have a teacher in the classroom or a support system where you can walk over and get an immediate answer. Now you have to make a phone call, or you have to send a text. You have to wait for a response. You're on hold for 45 minutes, and your stress level and your frustration level and the sense that you are isolated really, really rise to the forefront. So those things contribute significantly, not to say that there aren't mitigations for them, but you have to acknowledge them, that an online, remote, isolated learning experience can really be problematic in some instances.
Yeah, I think because, like you said, we sort of live in this world, even though we try to be sort of as unbiased as possible, it does come with a set of skills after a certain amount of years. You might not know the right answer, but I did it this morning. I had some comments disappearing in a document. So what do? I Google, like I'm used to that. Like I have a set of skills, whether born out of the fire or what, I don't know, but I have a set of skills that I know how to solve those problems. And
I do not. I called Jeff
I wasn't going to bring that up. Yeah. I've sat next to you for a while now.
No. Or I call Miriam and she comes over and helps me out.
Yep. No. But I think that one of the things, like if we're learning and development, again, like some of our listeners are on a team. Mm-hmm. We sort of have some of those skills built in, and without meaning to, we think like, oh, well, that's easy, or how could you not? And one of the things we talked about on a very prior podcast was, it's something as simple as, even if we don't have time to pilot materials, just slide that link over to somebody who has no understanding. Yeah. We talked about how we've had spouses and significant others review it. If they're lost, if they don't know where to click next or whatever, that's just a really small example. But that can help mitigate stress, because to us it seems simple, but it's not for someone in isolation.
Yeah, and if you know a thing, it's not hard to do it. If you don't know a thing, there's some, and then you add some time pressure to complete something, and then you realize that finding the answer that you need is incredibly complex. Well, yeah, your frustration levels go through the roof. So to mitigate some of these things, you know, obvious things, tech support really matters. Simple things like, I need somebody, that's going to take away a bit of that sense of isolation. It's going to lower frustration levels. It's going to lower stress for me if there's a place where I can find an immediate answer and I'm not searching and searching and searching. Part of it is clarity in design and function. And that means before we start building something, think about the learner who might be in isolation taking this thing. And they know a quarter of what you know as far as technical skills. What's that going to be like for that person? So design to the audience, design to a specific learner. I do a lot of public speaking, and one of the things that's helpful to me is to imagine in my mind the person, a specific person to whom I'm speaking. What's happening in the audience? And I can go above that person, I can go below that person, or I can do the hard work of figuring out where that person really is and then apply the message to that person. That's really important in instructional design, especially when somebody is isolated. And then it's things like figuring out, before I move on to that, one of the things you said is pilot. It's worth the time.
If you can.
And I don't know. I might argue that if you can't, you might not be ready to release whatever you're going to release. You really do need, if it's really all about learners, then piloting is going to be a big thing. And it doesn't have to take months. It can be done with 5 or 10 people. But all you're doing is checking your assumptions.
Yes.
Boy, I assumed everybody knew that. Well, not everybody knows that.
Well, and to your point about, I don't want to interrupt you here, but the person that you're kind of picking, who's my audience, again, it's going to depend on the size of company you're working with or who your learners are. But I have sometimes even picked the person who I often get the most questions from, the person who I do, you know, I don't say struggle, but sometimes wonder, how can you not understand this? Because if they can navigate it, I'm good.
Right.
You know, and so that's something to think about too.
Yep. Yeah. And then I think interactions matter. Mm. And again, we're going to start stepping into sociology here, but interactions with other people, so that even if you're interacting virtually, I mean, the best conversation you can have is like we're doing right now. You're sitting across the table from one another. I can see you. You can see me. I can see you leaning back. I see your eyebrows going up and down when I say something stupid.
Right? No eye rolls.
No eye rolls yet. We're not done.
No.
Yet. But all of these things are cues. When all of those cues are removed and you're interacting only with a 2D screen, an awful lot can be lost. So how do you figure out a way to get out of that 2D screen and bring in faces and people? And we can talk about some of that when we get to sociology. There are a number of benefits, psychological benefits. One is classroom distraction. I spent a lot of time in school, and one of my greatest I would have been much better as a remote learner. I am easily distracted by things that move. I'm distracted by sound. If I can sit quietly and read a book, I can pull all sorts of stuff out of that book. But if I'm sitting and cars are going by, I'm completely distracted. So it does eliminate classroom distractions. There's a tremendous benefit too, I think, psychologically, of being able to move at your own pace.
Right.
From both sides. I've been in classes where I immediately was far behind and I needed to catch up to everybody else while they were moving ahead and just the gap seemed to increase. I've been in other classes where I need this to go faster. I already know this and I'm familiar with this, or I've read about it, or I've experienced it, and I want to go faster. Moving at your own pace, I think, takes down my stress level because I'm in control now. I feel like I'm in, I'm doing what I want to do. And
that speaks to motivation too.
Yeah, it does. And I think that's an important benefit to be able to move quickly or slowly as needed. And then I think there's a benefit too of, and I hesitate to say this knowing your career in the classroom, but I've had excellent teachers in my life and I've had some really, really bad
for sure
teachers in my life.
Absolutely.
And, at some point, I think as a kid, I equated bad teachers and bad content, right? Like topics I don't like because the teacher I had, I really didn't connect with.
And that's only normal. Right. That's part of psychology.
Right. And there is a consistent delivery component of online learning, digital learning, that remote learning, I should say, that I think is really good, that everybody gets a consistent message and consistent opportunity to learn across the board, regardless of the person delivering that.
Well, and we've seen that a lot in the corporate world. So, I mean, a big part of the impetus to move things online, even prior to COVID, was we have, you know, instructor-led content, and we have these workbooks and all of that. And if you have the facilitator, who may not have any subject area expertise, but it's their job and they have a facilitator guide, and they may be amazing and you have the best experience ever. And then someone else in the company, same workbook, same facilitator guy, just wants to poke their eyes out and leave because it just wasn't a great experience. So the online piece, if there's time and it's designed well, we have level set now. Yep. Everyone's experience is very similar.
So kind of final word on that, from a design perspective, think significantly seriously about what it's like to be that person sitting potentially in isolation. Think through what adds and detracts from the stress level, depression, what's going to make them more frustrated or less frustrated, and what gives them a greater sense of community and less of a sense of isolation. Those are things you should write out and put on the wall of your cubicle, right? Just to keep that person in front of you.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's a perfect segue to sociology, because we've talked about this numerous times. The social aspects of feeling isolated, and what an amazing opportunity, even if we step outside of, say, designing a learning experience, creating a culture of learning in a company. Today's L&D, you know, departments in companies have this huge, amazing opportunity to create that culture. And it might not be related to any curriculum strand or any topic, but maybe they're setting up Slack channels that are more like fun related, or allowing people to share experiences or whatever. I mean, those are just little things we've discussed before, but somehow creating that sense of connectedness across the company in something kind of entirely unrelated. But if I feel connected to the people I'm still working with, I'm more motivated to jump in and take a look at whatever learning experience I'm supposed to be participating in now.
And that's really sociology. It's connections, right? It's studying the connection between two individuals. It's studying the connection, the connections that occur within a group made up of a whole bunch of different individuals, or how different groups relate to one another. So, and sociology is really informative here. The culture of learning is, the idea is sound. It's somewhat nebulous.
It is.
Because you don't really know when you have it. There are some indicators. You know, it's like dark matter. We know it's there. We just can't see it. And so that culture of learning, a culture of learning can be healthy, and it can be really dysfunctional.
Yes.
Too. And it usually masks the culture of the company. You don't usually have like a really healthy learning culture and a really dysfunctional corporate culture. They are
They go together.
Related. And so there are some things, you know, sometimes you create a fantastic learning experience and you deliver it into a dysfunctional system and it doesn't work, or it doesn't work as well as you thought. And it's very possible it has nothing to do with the learning itself, with the thing that you created. You may be fighting a bigger bear, and you're not really aware of it sometimes. So
yes, I mean, just practically someone sitting at home and they've got way more work than they ever could possibly hope to imagine, because that's the corporate culture and a lot of pressure to get it done now or yesterday. And then you deliver this experience and it's the last thing that they can, even if they wanted to, they couldn't do it.
Yeah. I'm supposed to work 40s and I'm working 60s and I'm behind and constant pressure. And then you ask me to take 2 hours off to do this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm
not going to do that.
I'm just pushing the next button as fast as I
possibly can. Yes.
The sociological stuff is an enormous concern in remote learning, because you are, given the definition of remote learning, you are remote. And how do you mitigate that? We can talk about that, but we have to acknowledge the fact that remote learning without significant thought and intentionality is going to drift to isolation. Mm-hmm. It's going to.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't just create great learning experiences and knowledge transfers and knowledge checks and so on, and have everybody pass quizzes and tests and so on, without really thinking through, at the end of this, how connected are these people going to be? How connected are learners going to be? And I would submit to you that the way to think about that is judge yourself on that. In this particular learning experience, are your learners likely to be more connected to one another or less connected to one another? And if you can think through those things and ways to mitigate it, and there are ways to mitigate it. I mean, you know, you mentioned Slack. You can create learning spaces.
Mm-hmm.
The first time you experienced that, I remember the first time I experienced a sort of a virtual whiteboard kind of thing. It wasn't the same as sitting in the room. It's when I was teaching, but it wasn't the same as sitting in the room with 12 MBA students. It wasn't as personal as that. But it was far different than me recording a lecture and then just sending it to them. I could see them. They could see me. We could react to one another. Okay, it's virtual. Okay, it's not as... It wasn't as fulfilling for me as sitting in front of students, but it was far better than just seeing comments that they were posting in a chat, where I couldn't see their faces and I couldn't see, were they leaning in or leaning back, were their arms crossed, right? Were they scratching their head, or were they scratching their dog, or doing something else? Who knows what else they're doing?
You know, and you bring in the dog, and that sounds silly, but I mean, I just think there's a whole lot more intentionality that this is forcing us to do when we start to consider sociology. You know, maybe when I consider everything, my audience, the content, what I need, whatever, maybe this truly just calls for a 15-minute learning module. Right. But because I'm considering, and it's e-learning, because I'm thinking of sociology and whatever, maybe we have a 10-minute wrap-up virtual ILT session.
Right.
Everybody jumps on. Maybe the only purpose really... It's not to rehash the content. Mm-hmm. It's to form those connections. And now I can see that Jack in that room, he's got a dog, and I can ask him a question. And we're forming those connections.
Yeah.
And so I just think there needs to be a whole lot more intentionality. There can be little pieces. There could be a Slack discussion. There could be a virtual ILT session. There should be a variety of modalities that we're delivering if we're considering sociology and wanting to help everyone sort of form those connected pieces.
Yeah, foster that.
Yeah.
That's going to be key. I think another thing you lose in true remote learning is feedback. Again, we can see each other. We are reacting to things far beyond our words. And so any way to get feedback, give it quickly, give it immediately, and give it as fully as you possibly can. It's, you know, doing some work in isolation, turning it in, and then waiting 5 days to hear something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
I've forgotten about it already. by that point, or I'm no longer interested in it, quite frankly. So any way to give feedback, you and I have talked about simple things like tone mm-hmm. and grammar.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I've told you the story that when I remember when email first came out, and as a time saver, I typed in all caps.
I remember.
Yeah. And finally, one of my assistants said, "Why are you yelling at me all the time?" I said, "What are you talking
right?
about? I am the least likely person to yell at anybody." And they said, "Every email feels like you're screaming at me." I had no idea what she was talking about.
Right.
And finally, she said, "Come here a minute. This is a normal email. This is your email." Just little things like that. But the grammar, the word choices, the word structure, the sentence structure, the tone of what we're saying.
Yeah.
All of those things are either going to draw me in or push me away. And again, if we're thinking about sociology, what we're attempting to do is draw people in, not push them
yes.
away. So, inclusiveness plays enormous here, because if I participate in a remote learning experience that's 20 minutes long and I don't see anybody that looks like me.
Or thinks like me, or
yep,
acts like me.
Sounds like
yes,
me.
Yep.
Yep. Or uses images, graphics that I'm familiar with versus things that I'm not familiar with. This is way beyond political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
This is absolutely mandatory. If you, again, care about drawing in versus pushing away. And I would leave that as the rubric that you want to judge what you're doing. Is this particular thing drawing in or pushing away? And once you start to think like that, things become pretty clear.
Yeah, and I would just, for our listeners, reference, I think it's podcast number 6. We'd have to go back, but we spent a pretty long interview, and it was a rubric from the University of Michigan Academic Innovation Center, diversity, inclusion, justice, yeah. equity issues. But they have a rubric that they sit down with faculty and help them sort of, and it's not a rubric to, I would say, it could be used to evaluate content, but it's mm-hmm. more of like pre-thinking.
Right.
Like, have I considered this? Have I considered that? What? And it goes, I think often in the corporate world, we see more of, well, let's just make sure we have some good images. And that's not even close to scratching the surface. If the examples, if the sometimes the language, the audio doesn't reflect who I am, it's fine. But like you said, I don't feel drawn in. It doesn't really relate to who I am.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't connect. So there's psychology and sociology just, I think, have to be at the forefront of. Everybody would think the cognitive sciences, and I'm not saying cognitive sciences, but they have to be at the forefront of your mind when you're designing, specifically if you are person-centric in your design.
Yes.
Because you're trying to understand the person, how they think, how they emote, how they engage, and then how they engage inside of a group or not. And those are pretty big features.
Yeah, I think those have to be compared. And I think as learning experience designers, we're trained, we probably have more formal training in that cognitive science area mm-hmm. and some in these areas. But these are the things that's what we kind of wanted to call out, some of the ones we might not be likely to think about. So, all right. Before we talk to consumer science, I'm going to drag our producer, Jeff, into this situation, too. So, Jerry and Jeff, I actually have a little exercise we're going to do here. Our listeners cannot see it, but I am pulling out a package of Twix candy bars.
I like this game.
Pacific Gold beef jerky.
Okay, I know my choice already.
Sweet tarts.
Oh, that's
and
mm-hmm.
two smaller squares of Ghirardelli Intense Dark Chocolate. Now, I'm putting all four of them here in the middle. They have their normal packaging. I will admit that the Twix is a six-pack, so there might mm-hmm. be some advantage there. But all I'm going to ask these guys to do is take a look, mm-hmm. and if you had to pick one today, which you will ultimately get to take with you,
nice.
All I want you to do is think about which one you want, and then why. And from a marketing standpoint, you're a consumer. You're going to make a choice here. So there's things beyond taste, but think in your head, what is drawing you to one of these things and why? And I'll give you a second to think about it.
Am I eliminating my already pre-bias that I have on the ones I like?
No. In fact, you can carry pre-bias right into...
I didn't know if we're strictly going off of design here.
No, not anything. Okay. So design what you already know about the taste, right? Like your pre-bias, perhaps what time of day it is.
I think you know what I'm going to pick, but I think I'm going to surprise you.
Okay. Well, actually, I would love to be surprised here. So I would, because I think I know what you're going to pick. And if you don't pick it, I'll take it home. Okay. So,
Jeff,
what do you think, Jeff?
Yeah.
First, I would go with sweet tarts. And the reason why is they're actually my favorite candy.
Oh.
So you ended up just picking one that I would pull out of the shelf regardless.
So it's based on... pre-bias, so to speak, like you have prior experience.
I have a
with
lot of
this.
Experience with sweet tarts.
Okay.
Yes, love sweet tarts. Wow.
Perfect. And it doesn't hurt that it's like a normal, a little bit larger box.
You got
than
the movie size.
I did
box.
The movie size. Yes. Mm-hmm. I know my audience here. Mm-hmm.
And those even have silly sayings on them, I believe.
Oh, they do. I didn't even see that. Oh, you're so right. Bold, you, shy.
You are
wise.
An aficionado of the sweet tart.
All right. Well, I'm gonna. So Jeff is a marketing expert as well. So he's bringing all that expertise here, but here you go.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Also to maybe make up for the small issue I might've caused with some files earlier today.
Oh, no issue.
All right, Jerry.
All right. Now I know you think I'm going to take the beef jerky.
That was my thought.
I'm going to take
That was my second
Ghirardelli
thought.
Ghirardelli chocolate.
Tell us why.
A couple things. I like blue.
Okay.
And these are wrapped in blue. In my mind, Ghirardelli has done a really good job of high end. Right? So it's quality chocolate.
You're a chocolate snob, is that what you're telling us?
I don't know if they actually are or not, but they have successfully communicated that to me in sort of the royal blue shiny package. I would choose it because it is dark chocolate, and it says intense dark chocolate. It's 86% cacao, and so, yeah, I don't like really, really sweet things.
Right.
And so for taste, but again, if I didn't know any of these products and I didn't know any of their names, I would probably still pick this based on the wrapper alone.
And it is the smallest by far.
It is the smallest.
But you're right.
Jeff, I look at your sweet tart box and that looks like something a 12-year-old.
I mean,
would,
it is
would
bright
be
pink
attracted.
And bright light blue, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, it really looks like something, you know, my granddaughter would pick.
It looks full of sugar.
Which,
it does.
Right.
And I wouldn't eat that.
That's,
so,
but that's because everyone has,
can.
Yeah.
I don't know if I should. But
I wish you will. I wish you will. Yeah.
Well, you guys both have just completely illustrated consumer science, but I think in an area where we are traditionally trained to think of it. Like I make my choices at the grocery store. I make my choices at Costco based on a million factors. Jeff, you could speak to this way more than we could, but what they look like, my former prior knowledge of the situation. You know, if cost goes up, it might be dependent on reviews and other things I've seen before I choose to make that choice, which sounds kind of silly because we're talking about learning here.
Oh, I actually, I love package design, like obviously in marketing design, but I will often find myself, if I don't know the object I'm buying, just basing it solely off of package design. And
really?
I feel like I mostly do that with maybe like a drink, like an alcoholic drink, if I'm getting like a seltzer I've never had, or a bottle of, I don't know, like of liquor bottles and wine bottles, I think is a really cool design aspect.
Interesting.
Them, how you ship them and how much it costs versus how it looks on a shelf.
Or how,
you know, does it convey the kind of alcohol that it is.
So you're a wine snob. I might be a chocolate snob, but you're a wine snob.
We could have a party.
Yeah, these go well together.
There we go.
A good Merlot and some intense dark chocolate go together.
But yeah, if I don't know anything else, I'm just going to look at good design.
Yeah.
Just because I like it.
So you can judge a book by its cover. And I think we all know that's true, even though we try to not. We all know it's true. It's kind of the world we live in.
So the way I think of consumer science is choices. The very first thing is choices. You have to make choices. And consumer science is right, and it's an economic point too, that you make those choices in the presence of scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
So you told us that you laid four things before us and we could pick one. If I could have picked all four, I would have picked all four. But you've said, no, I only get to pick one. Okay, now I've got to start thinking and comparing, and suddenly I'm deep into cost-benefit analysis and consumer science. And I think it's something that Jeff mentioned too, in looking at various bottles and labels. what gets your attention? That's, I think, ultimately what consumer science is studying. What is going to get your attention? And you think in the world of all the things screaming for your attention, we feel it most in the grocery store. I don't go to the grocery store a lot, but when I do, it's almost overwhelming. I have some good friends from Kenya, and I've been to visit them, and they've come and visited me. And I would take them to a local grocery store here that's a super whatever, and just take them down a dog food aisle or a laundry dish or a laundry soap aisle is just overwhelming. And I've been in their markets, so I know what their markets look like. how do you get in with so many things calling for our attention? And this is where it ties to learning.
Right.
And remote. If I'm sitting at home, there are all sorts of things screaming for my attention. One of them might be a child, right? Yeah. One of them might be a pet. But there are pictures that capture my attention. There might be a pile of laundry that's competing for my attention.
There most likely is.
Yeah.
The pile of laundry never goes away.
No, it doesn't. You know, kids running past the house, Amazon delivering a box. There's all these things. Now, you've put me in a remote situation. I'm in a familiar surrounding, but that surrounding is filled with potential distractions. And so you have to compete for my attention. And in some sense, and in a very significant degree, learning is constantly competing for attention. It's back to the person we talked about, Miriam, that's supposed to work 40 hours. They're working 60 hours.
Yes.
They're far
They have to make a choice.
They have scarcity of time. And now you're forcing me to do this. And this isn't an opportunity now. This is an annoyance to me because I don't have time for this right now. And I don't want to do it. You know, and so that's going to change how you think about things. Think through as an instructional designer, a learning experience designer, think through all of the things that you're competing with and how you are going to capture a person's attention. It really is learner design. I mean, you really are, it's designing things based on not just the learner and their psychology and their sociology, but all of the other things that are competing against your learning. How will you win that competition? And it is a competition. That's what marketing is all about. That's why you love marketing, Jeff, because you're an Olympic judge at that point. You're scoring items based on how they hit your eye, and how they might tap into a memory, or you know, or maybe you're looking shopping by price, and so all of those things, and somehow you know, end caps in stores and flashy, you know,
ease your, of access.
And, the sweet tart box looks very, very friendly. And inviting.
And this box is built to be shared and reclosed. So they're even now they're adding in packaging and things like that to help you separate your options.
Like, to be fair, that box will make it home to your house, probably not crushed. Jerry's might end up melted on the front seat if he accidentally leaves it.
No, chances are in the back seat, and then 6 months later, I'll find it.
But that's packaging.
Very possible.
Yes, yeah.
But you're really getting, you know, you're starting to touch on motivation here and what motivates someone to learn. You know, the best motivator is obviously, I need to know this right now because I need this information.
Yeah, it's
That's
practical.
That's beautiful, right? I'm going to pull it on my own. But if we are pushing learning experiences onto people, okay, what is unique and interesting and creative and aesthetically pleasing and compelling?
Yes.
For me to say, okay, you have my attention. Not that long ago, I was listening to someone give a speech, and I came in distracted. I had other things on my mind. I had other things to do. I didn't entirely want to be in the room I was in. And, this person began to speak, and within 2 minutes, he had my attention. And all that other stuff faded away. The information was thoughtful, it was helpful, it was high level, it was useful to me, and all of those things faded into the background. All the other things I was thinking about, and for the next 45 minutes, he had my attention. He captured it. Not easily done. How do you do that in learning? And how do you do that on a regular basis? That's a big challenge. And how do you do that now remotely?
Yeah, I think the engagement and the motivation piece comes first.
Yeah.
And then just in some of the reading that I've been doing too, it's the, as they're continuing throughout that, how can we help guide them to stay focused? Mm-hmm. So whether it's a little prompt here to remind them why it's important to what they're doing right now, instead of just my standard every three slides, I throw in a knowledge check. No, it's right. It's something that reminds them like, hey, you're going to use this later. Here's how. Or it might be a guide in navigation so that it's easy to get to the next step and they know how to get there so they don't get distracted with other things. And so I think we have two jobs. You know, we have to first engage them to help those distractions melt away. And then we have to help them stay engaged and motivated through a variety of ways to kind of guide them through it. Yes.
That's a battle. I mean, it's like you say, it's not just getting their attention, it's keeping their attention. And I don't know how big of a fan I am of the shortening attention span thing.
No.
I don't know that there's massive amount, but I tangentially, I'll tell you, sometimes I'll read biographies that were written 100 years ago, and they are thick. I mean, it's work. It's real work compared to a biography written now, which is a little more akin to Jeff Sweethearts, right? You know, it
packaged nicely and easy to digest.
Nicely, easy to digest, right? And you know, movies and television are cut and chopped in shorter and shorter sections. Although I saw a movie over the weekend that was 3 hours long, right? The new Batman, 3 hours long, and people sat in that movie and it did really well. And it's 3 hours long, and they paid attention the entire time. So it can be done. It's not that we can only concentrate for 8 seconds at a time. We really can concentrate.
Yes.
But the level of what it takes to maintain that attention, because attention is the most expensive real estate on the planet. That's why people spend so much money on marketing. Maintaining that is incredibly difficult to do.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up. So in this book I've been reading, I've referenced it a few times, but by Clark Quinn, he talks about, I was just deep into the brain science early part of the book, but he says, you know, attention spans really haven't changed. That's sort of that pop culture brain science. We all have the attention span of a goldfish. No,
yeah, I don't believe that either.
Right. He said that brain, that attention is processed in our cognitive architecture, and that hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. What has dramatically changed are the amount of distractions,
right,
which is exactly what you just said. So it's, we can, and I will say, I've noticed in my...
I would even say they're not distractions. I would say they are things that are competing for our attention. There's so much competition and smartphones, right? I mean, you think of, you know, people that can't have a conversation because their phone is on vibrate, and it vibrates for the text or a news article or an email or a phone call, and every 30 seconds, you cannot get their attention. Even though you're sitting 2 feet away from them, you cannot do that.
Yep.
And it isn't that they can't pay attention. It's that something else is constantly intruding into that attention space.
I will say that's the difference between $1 million app and a multi-billion dollar app. The thing you pay for in an app and what makes it popular is, why does it get your attention and what is its algorithm to get your attention?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why TikTok is so popular, because their algorithm is literally built to trick you to stay invested, whereas no one else can do that. They have a mathematical formula to that to keep you...
And now we're right back to cognitive science, because now we're talking about brain chemistry.
Well, right.
We're talking about
the
dopamine.
And,
I mean, it's so that's why these things are all siblings, and they all have to kind of inform things. And it places a huge burden on people that make their living and have their livelihood based on making learning experiences.
Yeah.
It is a wildly competitive arena that we're entering. And so our creativity and design have to match some of the best in the world, or we will lose our learners.
Yeah. And we also, on the other hand, have the science to back it up of, we have to be careful to not create cognitive overload. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, okay, should we put all of our learning? We're not advocating that everybody dump all their learning experiences into TikTok. I'm also not saying that we don't study that and use it when we can, but, when you create a learning experience that has so much cognitive overload, there's so much. One of the examples that was in this book was related to what our eyes can see and mm-hmm. the colors coming in, but how out of our periphery, we see things in black and white, but that, mm-hmm. So the color isn't a distraction, but it's highly tuned to pick up motion.
Motion. Yeah.
Yeah, which is why you're reading a book in a car and a car goes by, you're instantly not focused.
Yeah. I lose my spot.
Yeah. Which is why when we design cool learning experiences, then we have all these bells and whistles and they're supposed to be focused on something in the middle, but we got this stuff going on the side. Right. People are naturally distracted. Yeah. Like we've overloaded them.
Yeah. Watch CNBC or CNN. There are things running in the bottom.
Scrolling.
Often two layers of it.
Yep.
There's often something on the right. There's often something on the left of the screen. And there's three people in the middle of the screen all talking at the same time.
And disagreeing.
And yelling yes. at each other. I can't watch that.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm supposed to be paying attention to. So yes, you are throwing out a tremendous amount of information, but it's not related. And at the end of the day, it gives me a headache and I'm going to go read a book.
Yeah. So. Well, Jerry, you actually gave me a really good idea for a potential future podcast. So I know we've had different members of our team and we've even discussed what are some things that we've done to sort of like, I have noticed over the past 5 years, my attention span again dwindling, but the distractions mm-hmm. and my ability. And I think we could have a fun conversation about like some deliberate things we've done to start to build that back up again. Like mm-hmm. I've actually had to work at ways to minimize distractions and what do I do to do that? And then how do I train my brain again to refocus?
When and you know this because you sit next to me, but when I write and I do a lot of writing, my headphones are on and it sounds weird, but I am listening to 80s hair band rock music, hard rock music turned all the way up. And it blocks out everything. And weirdly, for some reason, my brain can block that out.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't do that at all.
That blocks out everything else, and my brain can block out the music, and I don't even hear it. If you asked me what was on right now, I would have no idea. But everything is gone. And that's, yeah. There are lots of tricks of, and some, like you would just hate that. You
right. Well, I have noticed, for example, like if I listen to Spotify, any music I'm familiar with, I think your brain can totally just completely blocks that out. If it's new music, like you get like recommended for you. Now, all of a sudden my brain's like, wait, what was that? What, and then I'm working on this. And what was that? And I'm very distracted again.
If I'm doing research, classical music.
Because then you're not distracted.
No words.
Right.
And so I'm not thinking about anything and it's soothing and calming and I'm giving myself time to contemplate things. Versus writing, which feels very intense.
Okay.
Much like that the makes music. Sense.
So it's motivating you. Yeah. 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 Okay. Well, I think maybe we'll have to take a look at that sometime. So cause I think it'd be another fun conversation. But I do really appreciate you joining us today, Jerry. Mm-hmm. And I think we've talked through some topics, some learning science that our listeners can try and apply. Think about, certainly there's a ton more resources out there.
Yeah.
But boy, I really think psychology, sociology, and consumer science are things that have to be considered every time you design.
And the challenge is growing.
Yes.
And if you're not considering them, you will be left further and further behind.
Yes, especially in light of our remote learners.
Yep.
So, yeah. So I had one final thought for you, a question. I guess typically at the end of the podcast, we always ask, you know, a new guest, what are you learning well now? And you're not even really a guest per se, Jerry. You're part of the family. You're a co-host. So,
well, thank you.
So my question is, in all of the study you've done on learning science, what would you say is kind of like one either really interesting thing you've learned, something you didn't know, or just something that you've really had to stop and think about?
The psychology and sociology part is fairly natural. Because I don't know how you do that without, I don't know how you build a learning experience without thinking about the person. The stuff that feels newest to me in the place where where it feels like I have the most to learn is in really thinking through consumer science and attention. The deeper I got into the competition for attention, the more challenging remote learning
I would agree for sure.
And it's we have to up our skills. We just have to, it's funny to say, you know, you're building a learning experience and I have to be a world-class marketer.
Right.
Well, I don't know if it goes that far, but you have to be a world-class thought leader on consumer science and attention, attracting attention and retaining attention mm-hmm. is the way I guess I would say it. So that's it.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I, you know, thinking through that, one of the most interesting transitions when I came out of the classroom, I mean, I taught largely freshmen. You have a classroom full of 35 high school freshmen who don't really want to be there.
And what could they possibly be distracted by?
Well, that and right. Yes. And so, I mean, it was really survival. I learned to switch things up like every 10 minutes and we were always doing activities. Frequently there was food involved. When I switched to, you know, developing online content, like that thought was in the front of my head, sort of that consumer science thought, because I'm like, I have to keep these people interested. But boy, did it take a while to figure out how to do that. And that's been 20 years now. Yeah. And we're in a whole nother world now of trying to figure out how to best capture attention. So it's an excellent point. And it's something I think even if our listeners have had experience in the past, they really need to think through it again.
For me personally, most of my teaching level was at the master's level.
Right.
I came in with the assumption, you know, I'm the prof, you're the student, shut up and listen, right?
Okay, never mind.
I assumed you're adults.
Right.
I'm an adult. I don't have to motivate you. You're paying money to be here. You could be out watching basketball or having a drink with Jeff or whatever, right? And you chose to be here. And I chose to be here. False assumption, right. Really, really bad assumption. And so I had to work far harder than I thought I would, even though we were in person. I mean, we were in the same classroom. Motivation and attention, I had to learn to compete for that. And I was just arrogant at the beginning, thinking, well, I have this great knowledge and information, and I have these great books and articles that you're going to read, and you're going to love it as much as I love it. Nope, we're not.
Well, and to be fair, even if they wanted and were motivated, again, we're talking about the distraction. You're an adult learner. You just came from working 8 hours a day.
Exactly.
You've got kids at home. You're missing putting them to bed. You've got a load of laundry, whatever. So there's always that distraction.
Yeah, I was really mistaken on that. It didn't work. It didn't help the learners.
Well, in your defense, I will say, having seen a lot of that, you adapted quickly.
I did.
You're a very popular professor. So
thanks.
Yeah. Well, I just want to thank our listeners today for joining this conversation. We have a couple more coming pretty soon here in the kind of the learning science area, so that will be exciting. If you're looking to interact with us more, you can find our posts on our Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And we're hoping to have some more audience interaction on this topic. We'd love to host a Q&A session at some point. But thank you all for listening. We know your time is a gift, and we thank you for choosing to spend it with us.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.